am Cynthia L. Simmons, and I am a member of Daughters of the American Revolution. And we are all about remembering history and not forgetting. And let me tell you a story to explain why we feel so strongly. I have a letter that I found when I emptied my father's house. And I know that that letter came from a member of my family. It's written by a wife, and she is begging her husband to come and let her know what's going on, to give her information, to let her know what she needs to do about this particular problem. But I don't know who wrote it, because she called him dearest, and she signed it with the little name that he used for her. And so that does not match any of the people in my family tree. When it comes to our nation, and when it comes to the Constitution, we do not want to forget those people who wrote this document and who gave us the fantastic nation that we've got. And that's why I have with me Craig von Busick. He is a historian and an author, and we're going to ask him about the writers of the Constitution. Welcome, Craig.
Well, thank you, Cynthia. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
And you are such a wonderful historian. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I understand that James Madison did most of the writing of the Constitution. Is that right?
Yes. As a matter of fact, he had been thinking about this for years before the actual Constitutional Convention in 1787. And so when he arrived there in Philadelphia, his plan was already written in detail.
Wow.
And so he was well prepared. You know, he was neighbors with Thomas Jefferson, and they had been sharing letters, and Jefferson would give him books, and Madison would loan Jefferson books. And so they realized that this was a major problem. I mean, you had Virginia almost going to war with Maryland over fishing rights in the Potomac River. You had New Jersey and Connecticut almost going, and I'm talking about war. I'm talking about bring out the guns and shoot people, war between New Jersey and Connecticut against New York, because New York has, as we all know, this amazing harbor. And so they were charging exorbitant rates for New Jersey and Connecticut to get their goods, even though they lived right across the river. So it was a very difficult time where it was basically, even though they called themselves a confederation, they called themselves united, they really were not united, and they really weren't a country. They were, you know, 13 countries who didn't know exactly what they were doing.
And they didn't cooperate with each other, apparently.
No, they didn't. They, because, you know, you remember the mindset, they had come out of a European system where every little fiefdom was a country. They didn't really see themselves as much states in the way that we think of it right now. They saw themselves as countries. And I mean, you even see that in the language going all the way down to Robert E. Lee. I can't raise my sword against my country, he said. And so that, you know, I mean, his father fought with George Washington. So that was passed down. They recognized that they needed mutual protection. They recognized that they needed to have trade, but then they never cooperated with each other on that mutual protection, and they never cooperated on trade. And one of the biggest things was that they did not allow Congress and in the federal level to raise taxes. So there was no way for the federal government to have an army. There was no way for the federal government to do the things that they needed to do unless they went with their hat in hand to the various states and asked them for a gift. And of course, how many of them are going to do that? They're just not going to. Madison and Washington and Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton and John Adams, they all saw this and said, we have a major problem, and we may end up with either three different nations, the South, the Middle Colonies, and the Northeast, or maybe even 13. And so it was a crisis.
So how much of this document did James Madison write before the Constitutional Convention?
Well, he came up with what was called the Virginia Plan. Virginia was it was by far the largest state in population, almost twice as big in population as New York or Pennsylvania. And so it had, you know, it was the big gorilla in the room, the Old Dominion. And so for them, they thought, well, we should have representation in Congress based on population, because of course that would give them this great amount of power. And so he came in with this plan of forming a federal government that would be separate from the states, but in many ways equal to the states, in that the states would have certain things that they would oversee, you know, things like roadways and things like internal issues and issuing a driver's license today, that kind of a thing. Whereas the federal government would be taking care of things like trade agreements with other nations and federal, highways and river systems. And of course, maybe the most important of all, mutual protection for all of the states. So he introduced this, and it was the first major thing to come forward in the convention, but there was a long way to go. So in a way, he had some of the document written, and then some of it was taken from some of the state constitutions, but there was a lot of compromise yet before they were ready to take it to Congress, and then from Congress to the states for ratification.
So what did they have to hammer out?
It all comes back to power and who's going to have the power. The states had seen, as I said, had seen themselves as sovereign states. Really, in their thinking, they were nations. And so they didn't want to give up their power as a nation, especially states like New York, which had an amazing amount of power because of their harbor, and because that was where a lot of the important governmental things had taken place. You know, it was along with Virginia and Pennsylvania, New York and Massachusetts. Those were the big four. And so they really fought this tooth and nail. New York fought the Constitution all the way to the end. But there was also major issues with the bigger states versus the little states, because the smaller states like Delaware or New Jersey or Rhode Island, they did not like the idea of having a Congress that was based on population, because right. They knew
they'd
that the bigger
traveled.
States would rule and they would have no voice and they would be neglected. And they knew human nature was that they would be neglected. And we know that that's the truth even up to today.
Yes.
And so they fought this. And so New Jersey came out with the New Jersey plan. So you had the Virginia plan that came from Madison. And then the delegates from New Jersey said, we recommend that we have a Congress that is based on two votes, or actually they said one vote, because that's how it was in the government that existed under the Articles of Confederation. It was one vote per state, and you had to have a two-thirds majority. So that was another problem. They weren't getting anything done. They didn't have a simple majority. They needed a two-thirds majority. And on some things, they needed unanimity. I mean, it's hard to even imagine.
You can't get anybody to agree.
Very rare that would happen. And yet some of the most important things had to be unanimous. And so they said, we recommend one vote per nation or per state. So there was this back and forth, and it almost all broke up. And then amazingly, Benjamin Franklin, who was at this point very old, and he was a deist. And deists believed that God kind of set the universe in motion and then went off and, you know, went to the summer home and wasn't really paying attention. It shocked a lot of people, and still shocks us today, that Benjamin Franklin said, gentlemen, I think we need to stop and we need to pray and we need to seek the guidance of providence in this most important hour. That you almost wonder, how in the world did that happen?
Right.
You know, Benjamin Franklin was a genius politician and diplomat. And so he may have just been telling them what they wanted to hear for the purpose of bringing them together, because the majority of the people in that room were Bible-believing Christians who did believe in a personal God that they could pray for. And so Benjamin Franklin may have thought, well, maybe this will bring some unity, even though I don't believe in it. Whatever the reason, they prayed, and there was a change. And what happened is a man named Roger Sherman, who, if you ever watched the musical 1776, he's one of the guys there who was on the Declaration Committee. I love that musical. That was the thing that got me interested in history when I was a little kid. Love that musical. But Roger Sherman from Connecticut signed the Declaration of Independence. He signed the Articles of Confederation. And later he would sign, and he's the only one who would also sign the Constitution, the only one. And he came forward and said, what if we made a compromise? What if we split Congress into two houses? A bicameral legislation is what they called it. And we have a House of Representatives that is given seats based on population. So that takes care of the big states, Virginia and Pennsylvania and New York. And then we have a Senate that is of equal power, but you have two senators per state. That took care of the small states. They agreed on that. And then in the midst of the debate, there was a lot of concern. And remember the mindset, they're coming out of being under a very tyrannical monarch in King George III. And so they did not want a king. They didn't want a monarch, and they were even afraid of a Congress that was too powerful. And so they said, what if we split up? And one of the people who started this was Alexander Hamilton. We need to separate powers, and there should be a legislative branch and a judicial branch. And unfortunately, he used a word that was a no-no, and he said a monarch. And that was, everybody shot him down, and he didn't really have much say after that. In fact, he was like, we don't really need to give the states too much power. It should all be in the federal government. He went to the other side. Well, you know, people were just like, forget this, although they liked the idea of breaking up
the three branches.
And so what happened is this placed Madison's proposals in the center. So you had the New Jersey plan was on the one wing, and then Hamilton was on the other. And all of a sudden, Madison was looking like the most balanced idea. And so they kept hammering and making compromises, and they were able to get very close. But then another major issue arose, and that was what to do about the slaves in the South. Obviously, at this point, the North had pretty much abolished slavery by that point. There had been slavery in the North, but by this point, it had been abolished. But the Southern states, who were dependent on this free labor for right. their agrarian society, kept the slaves. And so they wanted to count the slaves as people so that they got more representatives mm-hmm. in the House of Representatives. Well, the Northerners said they shouldn't be counted at all because they're slaves and they don't have a vote, and so they shouldn't be counted. So they came up with this infamous compromise called the Three-Fifths Compromise. So basically they said, you know, five slaves are equal to three free people. And so we'll give you people for every five slaves in your population count, and that will then go towards increasing your number of people. Well, that in the House of Representatives, that actually gave a lot more power to the slave states, which they used all the way up to the time of the Civil War, mm-hmm. When, of course, that was abolished. With that compromise, the group was able to vote, and there were enough votes to ratify or to pass the Constitution the way it was. And as you said, Madison was the one behind it. He was the one driving it. The crazy thing is he was also taking notes in shorthand.
Wow.
And then at night he'd go home and he would transcribe it. So he said later that that whole time almost killed him.
I bet it did.
It almost took away his health.
Yeah.
But they got it done. Now they sent it to the Congress. Well, the issue was that the Congress had appointed these delegates given charge to these delegates to gather, not to come up with a new government. They said to
fix the old one.
Yeah, to fix the old one. Mm-hmm. Well, here this committee comes back and says, we're getting rid of the old, and this is what we're proposing for the new. Well, the Congress didn't like this because it was taking away their power. However, most of them knew that something had to be done. Delegates were able to say it was a unanimous vote because all of the dissenters from New York and Rhode Island had left and didn't vote against it. The people in all the 13 states thought, well, then this, if it was unanimous, then this is the heart and the will of the Congress. And so the Congress actually lost its influence. And at that point, they kind of just rubber stamped it and sent it off to the states. However, they said the states should be able to add amendments as they see fit. That is where it was at that point.
I was looking at some of the people that were in the Congress, and it looked like not everybody that was there signed it. Now, do you know what happened there?
Well, there were some who just dissented, and so they refused to sign it. There's a wonderful Institute of the Constitution in Philadelphia, and in their grand hall, they have bronze statues of all the people who were delegates to the convention. All of them but three are gathered in one part of the room, and then the other three statues are far off in the background. But they're there. Well, those are the three who didn't sign. I thought it was really wise of the curators of the museum to have them there because they were part of the process.
Right.
And really, one of the things that the Constitution, and especially the Bill of Rights, which we're going to talk about in a second, ensures is the process of debate and the process of representative government. And these were representatives. They were represented in Congress, and then the Congress sent them to this convention. And so they should be in this constitutional museum. But because they refused to sign, they're off on the other side.
Stuck off in another room. Did James Madison actually publish all the stuff that he wrote down at night?
Yes, they're available. And there is some controversy because there are some people who say, well, isn't it convenient that the Federalist who wanted to scrap the old articles is the one who gives us the notes? How do we know that the notes really were what people were saying? Or did Madison just kind of, fudge the books a little bit to get his point across? Only God knows that. So, but those notes are out there. You can read them.
That's interesting. I did not know that he wrote everything down. I've heard of the Federalist Papers. Is that a separate document?
Yeah, what happened now is that when the Constitution went to the states for ratification, it needed 9 of the 13 states to vote in favor of it in order for it to pass. And so each state had major conventions of their own where it was debated. There was a lot of pushback from just because it was change and that people, certain people didn't want to lose their power. Other people didn't like the idea of a president. We don't want to, that's a slippery slope towards a king or a queen. So there was all kinds of debate about this. But then there were a lot of people who they said, we want this, my home is where the laws should be made for my life. And so local laws and state laws, I don't need some president or some Congress in, back then, Philadelphia or New York or eventually Washington, D.C., making laws for my life. And so there was a lot of pushback. And so what happened is that Madison spoke with John Jay and with Alexander Hamilton and said, we need to start writing articles to defend the concept of a federal government and this constitution. And so one by one, they started putting out these documents that you mentioned, the Federalist Papers. And they're some of the most important political thought in American history. Amazing, amazing thought that is in there. And here's where Hamilton restored his reputation to a certain degree, because he, you know, in the end, he accepted the compromises of the convention, and then he started to defend them. And he, by far, I mean, it's like 10 to 1, wrote the most of the Federalist Papers, just some amazing documents. And they had their effect because there was a shift. These papers, along with the Constitution itself, were printed like crazy and distributed throughout the country. And anybody who could read, they were reading these documents, and they were reading the Constitution. And one by one, starting with Delaware and then Pennsylvania and on down the line, the states started to ratify the Constitution. However, a lot of the states said, we have in our state constitutions, we have a Bill of Rights, and we know enough about human nature to know that your vague constitution doesn't speak about protecting my free speech or my freedom of religion or my freedom of assembly. And so we need specifics in amendments to give us specific rights. We now know, historically looking back, thank God.
Yes,
that we, that. Congress really was the one, because by this time it was out of the hands of the convention. And so Congress said, yes, we agree. And so they started to add the amendments one by one. And in the end, it got to 9 states, and that was it. And so it was interesting, because in the Articles of Confederacy, it says, we, the United States, and then it listed all 13 states, say this and that and the other thing. That was the Articles of Confederation. But in the Constitution, they not only changed it, but they also capitalized the words United States. And that was where we, as the nation as we know it now, that was our first birth, really. Because before that, it was, yes, they were lowercase united, quote unquote, states. They weren't really, not in fact. But when they came to the time where they ratified that Constitution, and then made it capital letters, and you could go look online, it says, we the people, in order to form a more perfect union, we the people of the United States Capitol. And that was the beginning of the nation that we know today.
Did any particular individual write the 10 amendments for the Bill of Rights?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't think it was any one particular person. I think it was a committee type of thing that happened in the Congress.
Okay. And I noticed that, like, 9 and 10, they said that whatever rights are not mentioned, they still exist, and they go to either the state or the individual. Now, why did they do that? That was kind of interesting.
That comes both from the Bible and Hebrew law, and also from British law and from the Enlightenment. It's a kind of amalgam of those three, in that they believed in what was called natural law. Under the monarchy system, they believed in what was called the divine right of kings, that God set the king in place. And so the king had authority from God, and everyone else had to listen to what the king had to say. Well, of course, you know, human nature doesn't like that kind of thing.
No.
And over many, many centuries, that kept getting thrown overboard with the Magna Carta, and then with the, you know, French Revolution, the American Revolution. So finally, with the American system, there was this understanding that we, you know, those who believe in the Bible believe that the rights come from God to us directly. There's no mediator. And that's why in the Constitution, they made those first three words so huge: we the people. Because they were saying, we're no longer under a king. We're no longer under a tyrannical ruler, a dictator, but the rights come and flow from the people. We give the right to the government, which represents us, to pass laws. And if the government fails to do what the people want, well, we have the right to rise up, whether it be at the ballot box or sometimes in a revolution, and overthrow that tyrannical system. Thank God that hasn't happened in our country. It's been, you know, in the ballot box and in times of debate. And hopefully that system will continue to happen. But then the other part of that was a recognition that it was almost like a teeter-totter with the rights. There were certain rights that the states had and then other rights that the federal government had, and that the federal government couldn't infringe on the states and the states couldn't infringe on the federal government. Now, guess what? We're still debating that today.
Yes, we are. We are.
And it's a never-ending balance. And so that's really where that language comes from, along with local control, because the states also can't tell a city or a township or town what to do in certain matters. And it goes from, you know, the individual all the way up to the federal government.
And we certainly have seen a lot of that tug of war between city and state and federal during this pandemic.
Yeah. And really, the pandemic is something that we've never experienced before. So really, what's going to happen when we are taping this? Yesterday, there was a recall election in California. Now, Governor Newsom was retained, but the whole election happened because of certain things that Governor Newsom did. And the people said, no, you've overstepped your authority. And so they gathered enough votes to have the recall election. Now, the people of California chose to keep him, but they could have chose the opposite. And it is all about the authority, bringing it back to the people. And so I rejoice at those kind of things, because that's what representative democracy should be.
Well, this was excellent, Craig. I really appreciate this. You filled in a lot of holes for me, and I know for a lot of people too. So
you can find Craig at vonbusek.com, VonBusek. And thank you again. And thank you for listening.